Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is podcast episode 87 for January 24th, 2012, Tuesday morning. Good morning, folks. With me this morning is Baggy the cat. Yesterday's podcast, I was all by myself. Baggy was asleep and Nikki was asleep and the house was relatively quiet. But this morning, Baggy is awake and she's winding around my feet, seeing if there isn't a way that she can jump up and knock over something. So at any particular point in time, the podcast may have an interruption, and I'll have to cut that out in editing. But if you're a regular listener at BadQuaker.com, you know that Baggy very much enjoys attacking the microphone and causing me to spend extra time editing to try to take out her hijinks. If you follow BadQuaker.com over on Facebook, click on the pictures on the for BadQuaker.com, and there's actually a picture of Baggy posed in one of her gargoyle-like stances that she likes to make, eyeing the microphone, thinking whatever kind of evil thoughts it is that she thinks about. Who knows what she thinks the microphone is, but she does. I think it because it has a windscreen on it, and that feels interesting to her claws. I think that might be part of the appeal, and the fact that we put our faces up to it and talk into it, that probably fascinates her to a certain extent. She'll occasionally come up and stick her nose up to it, so that could be part of it. Anyway, that's probably not why you're listening to this podcast. I wanted to start out, as I have done for the last few podcasts, by quoting L. Neil Smith once again. This is a definition of the non-aggression principle. Well, actually, it's a definition of libertarianism, but it's a direct reference to the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle. And really, the reason why that I keep bringing this up is because it is one of the primary focuses of BadQuaker.com. We have a couple things that we really want to emphasize, and the other things that we want to emphasize make no sense unless you grasp the zero aggression principle or the non-aggression principle. So, to quote L. Neil Smith, a libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right under any circumstances to initiate force against another human being or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim. L. Neil Smith. Now, I can't help but to point this out. You know, libertarianism has gone through some strange phases in its day. Going back, if you read some of Murray Rothbard's writings about the origin of libertarian thought, and he goes all the way back into the ancient, fathers of thought, one might say, and he brings together the different aspects of what each different scholar or each different thinker brought to the table, and eventually we got to the point of where we are today. And libertarianism didn't really start to, there were a lot of gaps and holes in the theoretical formulation of it, all the way up well into the 1900s. And, some of the, real foundational thinkers, you know, here's a good example. If you go to badquaker.com, you'll see these, ugly faces across the front of the screen there looking at you. Well, actually, it looks like only one is looking right directly at the camera. Well, maybe two. And I'm going to go ahead and I've gone through this before, but I'll go ahead and say who they are. To the far left, the white-haired gentleman that's kind of very stately in a nice suit and looking off to the side, that's Lysander Spooner. The next one we have with the interesting beard is Henry David Thoreau. And then we have Herbert Spencer kind of leaning back in his suit, and he's got a very narrowly trimmed beard with no mustache, and he is somewhat, well, quite bald. and he kind of has a disgusted look on his face. And part of the reason there is because I'm not sure Herbert Spencer was ever very happy. but he did add to our movement, as inconsistent as he was at times and as wrong on some things as he was at times. Herbert Spencer added to our movement, as did Henry David Thoreau, again, wrong on some things, but the things that he added to our movement were absolutely vital, and we wouldn't be where we are without him. The same way with Lysander Spooner. Lysander Spooner had a legal mind that was just phenomenal, and he was able to just cut right through all the fog and take it right to what true law was. And so then we can, okay, so we have Lysander Spooner, we have Henry David Thoreau, and we have Herbert Spencer. And then we have Mises kind of in a nice, more modern suit with the gray-haired gentleman with the clean-shaven, and he's kind of looking downward like he's reading something. He probably is. And then we have the happy guy, which is Murray Rothbard. And I love that picture of Murray Rothbard because Murray probably had a more consistently jolly outlook on life than any of those other characters in that lineup right there. And then, of course, I compliment myself by putting my picture to the far right with the silly straw hat and the braided paracord for a hat band. But yeah, so that's me, and hopefully I can add something to this mix. Of course, not in the league of the other five gentlemen in the pictures there, and that, of course, is why the wording across that says that one of these is not like the others, and so I don't mean to overly compliment myself by putting myself in their league, but what I am trying to say is that where we are today has been built upon line by line, jot upon jot, tittle upon tittle, until we eventually come to the point of where the theory is developed and where it makes sense and is consistent. And libertarianism... Well, okay, so that was our first interruption of the podcast, and it did not come from Baggy the cat. Nikki, the dog, decided to wake up and tell the world that she's awake, and evidently something outside must have happened that drew her attention. So she had to let everybody know that she was guarding the house. And I'll do my best to clip that out and try to make sense of this. So where was I? I think I was talking about... Oh, I remember. So where we are in libertarianism is the result of a long series of people who were partially right and partially wrong until we got to the point of where we are now. Now, that's not to say that we're entirely right on everything now. We still have details to work out. But what we have now is these key principles. We have refined our thinking so that we're based on these core principles. And with them, we can hold this up and judge everything that is presented to us and decide, is this libertarianism? Is this truth and right, or is this injustice and is this wrong? And using that perfect image, you know, I think of some years that I've spent around machine shops, and you can't be much of an engineer if you haven't spent at least some time around machine shops. And I was fortunate enough that as a young man, my father was gifted in anything relating to machines. So he would, whenever he would get the invention bug, I would end up with him in the machine shop, and he would be in there late at night inventing whatever it was, whatever device that he had would sparked his imagination. And I'd be sweeping the floor or whatever, just trying to keep busy and help him as much as I could. So if you're in a machine shop, there are certain things that you use. Like, for instance, they'll have a large, heavy stone with a perfectly flat surface on it. And if you want to find out if something is perfectly flat, you lay it on that standardized surface. And the reason that they use stone is because it's less, like if you use a flat steel surface, or a flat iron surface, then as the temperature of the room changes, the shape of that steel or that iron will change as well. But stone resists those changes. It holds its shape better than a metal does. So you have this large, heavy slab of stone that's had the surface polished and cut to an exact flat surface. And then you can take anything that you want and you can lay upon it. And that stone surface is your standard. It is perfectly flat. And you when you set it all up, you set it up as level as well. So you have it flat and level. And then you can take anything you want to measure and you put it on there. And that will tell you, you just look at it and roll it across that surface and it will tell you if that thing is flat and level or not, because you have the perfect surface to test it by. Now everybody pretty much knows what a tape measure or a ruler, a rule stick or a ruler or a yardstick, pretty much everybody knows what those are. But when you get into a machine shop, you get precision measurement devices that you literally check your yardstick with, or you check your tape measure with. These are the devices that are so precise that you use them to measure other measuring devices with. And that's where we're at in the libertarian movement. When we take things like the first principles that we've grasped onto, we understand things like the zero aggression principle. We understand that we can use it to set it up to other things and say, does this measure up to the standard? And if it does, then we know that's good and we can embrace it. But if it does not, then we have got to reject that thing. And it doesn't matter how much we love it or how much we are attached to it it doesn't matter if we think it will do good. If it doesn't measure up to that standard, we must reject it. I spent years in the aircraft engine industry, and the level of precision in there was so important because, you know, a single jet engine has just a blinding amount of parts within it, tiny little pieces, some not much bigger than the head of a pin, and others that are very small, like the size of your little finger, but are highly complex with different angles cut into them and different passageways that go through them at different angles to get the air to move in specific ways and so forth. Very, very intricate little pieces that go into a jet engine. And each of those has to have a certain amount of precision to them. Otherwise, if they fail, or if they fail to do what they're designed to do, you can have a tremendously horrible outcome from that. You can have a jet airliner crash and hundreds of people die. Or you can have multiple airliners crash and you don't know why they crashed. Or you can have military aircraft that fail at critical moments. And so in the aircraft industry like that, parts would come across my desk and there would be not necessarily even a flaw, just a level of unsureness as to whether it was exactly precise, and we had to stop it right there. It couldn't go any further until the question was settled, and it didn't. And we would have people. I would have suppliers calling me who had supplied this part, and they would do everything from beg to physically threaten me to get their parts authorized to go through the process and into production. And you can't do it. It doesn't matter how important you think it is that this part goes through. Until it's set up against the standard and measured, it cannot be accepted. And how critical is it when it's going on a jet airliner that can handle a few hundred people, as opposed to how critical is it when we're talking about something that affects an entire nation or an entire continent or an entire race of human beings? How important is it then? How important is it to hold it up to that standard and measure it and say, does this fit the zero aggression principle, or is this flawed? And if it is flawed, we cannot accept it. We have to reject it. Okay, so for an introductory where I was just going to read L. Neil Smith's little statement, that kind of got long-winded. What I really wanted to talk about tonight, I'm sorry, I told you this morning, it's still dark. Oh, and my brain hasn't started functioning, and I haven't had any coffee yet, so please forgive me. But what I did want to talk about was the slow, gradual drift. Well, it used to be gradual. It's not gradual now. But the drift from having police to a police state. Now, this can be very touchy because, for example, I know that there are, well, there's at least a couple of police officers that listen to this podcast, and I know there's at least one and perhaps two police trainers that listen to this podcast, and I know we have a couple sheriffs. And so I'm not trying to kiss up to them or do anything or say anything that's going to try to you know, whitewash any facts, but I'm also not attempting to insult them in any way because, well, I'll get into it, but your typical person who decides that they want to become a police officer or a sheriff or whatever, the average person who does that does not do it for bad reasons or for some kind of evil intent. They do it because they have a desire to do the right thing, to serve their community, and they want to make a difference. But there's a flaw built into the system, and that's what I wanted to talk about. Some people don't realize that the concept of actual police is relatively new in Western civilization. If you go back into the 1700s, there were no police. The police were pretty much invented by a guy named Robert. Oh boy, I should have had a note on that. You would think I would take notes. I mean, I have some notes, but you would think I would put this in my notes. But I can't remember the guy's name. But if you, I'm sure if you Google, anyway, his name was Robert something or other, and that's where we get the English phrase of calling police officers bobbies. And some of the things that he introduced were, for instance, wearing common uniforms that were semi-military uniforms, but not really military uniforms. This was one of his concepts, so that you could distinguish the police officer immediately as opposed to just your average citizen walking down the street. The original police officers were not armed. They carried a nightstick and a whistle, and that was pretty much it. And of course, they had their little copper shield, and the copper shield was to display who they were and identify them as a police officer, and that's where we get the word copper, and that's where we get the word cop, because the original little shield that they used was, of course, it was a sort of a psychological fallback to them being knights protecting the citizenry, but it was actually just a little copper shield with their name and their who they were and so forth, so they could be identified. And that's where we get the phrase. Even if you watch the old movies, you know, the old movies from the 30s and so forth, the gangster movies, and they would occasionally call the police officers coppers. And that was a lot more common in the 1800s, especially in the big cities, because the reference to their little copper shield that they wore. Now, of course, we know that as these traditions moved into America, into the Old West and so forth, the more English type traditions washed away, and so some of the police officers preferred a star, especially those of the Texas variety liked the star. And so some police officers ended up using a star while some used the old shield. Either way, it was a badge indicating that they were somehow different from the rest of the public. Now, all that is just boring history that probably almost all my listeners already knew. And it has nothing to do with the flaw that I said that was designed into the system. If we go back to the original need for police officers, specifically in London, in the late 1700s and early 1800s, well, you say, well, something has to be done because there was crime, and crime was getting out of control. Well, let's remember something. London, in, let's just say, the year 1800, London was already roughly 1800 years old by that time, something like 1750 years old. In 1800, I'm saying it again for impact, London was already over almost 2,000 years old. So it had existed as a city for a very long time with no police. Now, that's not to say there was no law enforcement. That's not to say it was wild anarchy. Woo! No, there was not chaos in the streets. It was not just rampant murder and lawlessness. That's not what... A city doesn't exist like that for 1,750 years. There was law in London. But here's the problem. When the Norman Conquest took place in 1066, prior to that... there was no real state in England all the way going back to the 500-600 AD when Rome fell apart and they abandoned Britain. During that time frame, all of England was stateless. And again, that doesn't mean lawlessness and that doesn't mean chaos. It just means there was no state. There was still local government. There was still organization, there was still law, there was still judicial authority. All these things existed, but without the aggression of the state. And that's the key. Everything was voluntary. Now that's not to say that if somebody didn't want to obey the laws, they could just go do whatever they wanted. No, society has, when there is no state, society develops checks and balances within itself to take care of these things. And they had functioned in that capacity all the way up into the 1700s. But the problem was the state in England had been developing and growing since the Norman invasion in 1066. So from 1066 until into the 1700s, the state had progressively got more and more and more powerful. Most notably, when Cromwell's government... Well, first off, Cromwell introduced what was referred to as the New Model Army, and that was a major leap in the development of the modern state. When Cromwell fell away and lost control and eventually died, and England went back to its monarchy with its parliament to keep it in balance and all this kind of thing, they kept Cromwell's New Model Army. And so each aspect of the state developed a piece at a time. So the worst part of the state added with another worst part of the state. And by the early 1700s, you had essentially the birth of the modern state in England. And a similar thing was taking place in other locations as well. But since the idea of a cop came out of England, we're focusing on that in this particular telling of the tale. So as the state continued to develop, you see, what is it that I've said about the state over and over? The state creates an immunity for the actions of individuals. The state provides an opportunity for people to act without consequence. And so it has this tendency to draw into itself the worst types of human beings, the types of human beings who want to dominate other human beings and not be responsible for their actions. That's what the state provides to the human psyche. So it tends to draw to itself people who have a tendency to want to dominate other people and not be held responsible for it. So even when people start out, well, I'll get into that in a minute, how the majority of people in government start out to do the right thing, but how the process itself draws in the worst and brings out the worst in people as it goes through the system. Okay, so in the late 1700s, England had developed enough characteristics of the state that lawlessness was beginning to become a real problem. And the more concentrated the population becomes in one geographic area, the more of this lawlessness becomes apparent. And again, it is directly due to the existence of the state by creating a situation where you have a class of people in the community who are immune to the consequences of their own actions, and they have authority. This creates a scenario where it perpetuates a cycle of more and more and more crime. So So in this process, people around 1800 in London, seeing the overwhelming amount of crime that was taking place, demanded that something be done. As always, they always want something to be done, but they don't want to do it themselves. They want the government or the state or the king or whoever. They want somebody to do it, but they don't want to do it themselves. They don't have to. That's what the state is for. See, that's the other aspect of the state. People are drawn to the state. People are drawn into the state because of what I said a second ago. They have this flaw in them that makes them want to dominate people, and they want to be able to not be held responsible for their actions. But then there's this other appeal to the state, and that is that I don't want to actually get involved, so I'd rather that the state takes care of these things for me. I don't want to confront, you know, Mr. Smith about his activities, so I'll just let the state do that. I'll call the police and let them deal with it. And so there's this two-sided thing. You see, the nosy neighbor doesn't want to come over to your house and say, hey, you know, that bush is kind of obnoxious, and, you know, would you like some help trimming it, or do you really like the way that bush? The neighbor doesn't want to do that. So what do they do instead? They anonymously call the city and turn in your ugly bush as an eyesore. And they try to get the city to do something about it for them, because they don't want to actually suffer the consequences of standing forward and saying, look, I don't like your bush. I think your bush is ugly and makes our whole community look bad. I think maybe you ought to trim that thing or cut it out altogether and plant something that's more attractive. They don't want to do that because that would cause them to take responsibility for their own actions. They'd rather anonymously call the city and complain and make the city come out and give you a ticket. But the long-term effect of this, these are acts of immorality. When you're using the aggression of someone else to do your bidding for you without any consequence on yourself, this goes back to the zero aggression principle. Eventually, this will produce bad. You can't do bad and produce a long-term good. If you, even if it's a little bad, even if it's a tiny little bad, eventually it will produce a larger bad. It will never produce a good. Okay, so let's go back to the cop story again. So by the 1800s, there was a serious need for police in not only London, but pretty much all bigger cities in the West, in, you know, Western culture. So the state has an answer. So the state has a group of people that they put in a costume. They're not really military, but it's sort of a military-like uniform. But either way, they put them in this costume, and they put on them this badge, this shield, this thing that falls back to a previous mythology of the knight. Something that people will have some level of respect for. And they give this person a certain amount, just a little bit, of immunity for his actions. In other words, if there's, even in 1800, you have two guys walking down the street. Each of the two guys has a piece of wood in his hand. And each of the two guys sees someone that's doing something that they don't approve of. And each of the two guys whacks the guy with his piece of wood. Now, what's going to happen to the first guy who is not wearing the costume with the little shield, the badge? What's going to happen to him as opposed to the guy with the costume and the badge? Remember, 1800s. You see, even then, the cop was given certain immunities to his actions. Now, here's the thing of it. Let's take this in a completely different direction. Think of the old television show with Sheriff Andy and Deputy Barney Fife. Now, what we have here is we have sort of the image of two different types of people that would police work would appeal to them. We have the Sheriff Andy character, who is pure of heart. He's strictly there to serve the community and to help people. He's wise. In addition to wisdom, he has a level of intelligence too. He's quite clever. He has a lot of experience dealing with people, and he uses that experience and that wisdom and that cleverness to figure things out and to keep the peace in the community. And when someone needs to be arrested, he's right there and he does his job. Now, contrast that to Barney Fife. Barney Fife is a bit of a comedic buffoon, and of course he's there for comedy relief. So let's take that part out of the mix, because that's television. But what we have within Barney is this deep desire to dominate people, to be a big shot, to be respected, to be the one that everybody looks to and treats differently. Now, those desires are not in Sheriff Andy, but they drive Barney. They drive Barney to constantly be puffing his chest up and showing his authority in one form or another. Now, like it or not, police work appeals to both these two types of people. Now, I would say that during my lifetime, let's just say prior to the last couple years, prior to the last 10 years, the vast majority of police officers on any level, police, sheriff, highway patrols, the vast majority of these people that I have encountered have mostly been of the Sheriff Andy type. It was their deep desire to do good, to help the community, to make a living. You know, it's not a charity thing here. Even Sheriff Andy made a living at what he was doing. But the point is that they wanted to do good. They wanted to help the community. They wanted to fight the forces of evil and make the world a better place. That was their deep desire. And yet, even with their desire being in that direction, there are still some that work their way in who are there for the purpose of self-gratification, for the purpose of self-glorification, and for the purpose of dominating other human beings. And they are there specifically because they can do it in that capacity with little or no repercussions for their actions. Now, they have to be careful, because in the past, there was a lot of cross-checking of police. There really was. It seemed, when you look at old Rodney King videos and things like that, you think, well, the cops have always been out of control. Some always have been. But, and this is what I'm saying, going all the way back to the 1800s, the two guys walking down the street, they both have sticks, only one has the costume. This problem existed then, but it was a minor problem compared to now. And the reason why, there are three processes that guarantee that eventually the what might be called the Andy cops are going to be pushed to the side and given into lesser and lesser and lesser roles. And the Barney cops will be pulled into higher and higher positions of authority. And this entire thing that I'm talking about not only applies to police, but it applies in a variety of other governmental offices and agencies as well. It's just that it's very apparent with police, because it's very rare that, an FDA inspector will, you know, beat someone or spray them with pepper spray or shoot them for no reason whatsoever. So, okay. Now let's get into, before I do that, before I go into the next section, I wanted to talk about one other thing that this is going to be separate from my three things that I mentioned a second ago. One other thing that throws, this entire process way out of balance. And that is this weird, bizarre war on drugs that so many people are convinced is a good idea. In order to believe that the war on drugs is a good idea, you have to completely separate yourself from logic. Now, by saying that, I'm not saying that drug use is good, or that people should have, that everybody should be shooting heroin, or I'm not advocating any of those things in any way. What I am saying is the prohibition of any substance is silly. It's in addition to it being a blatant violation of all of rights, it's just silly. The government has never been able to successfully prohibit anything. If you go back and you understand about how silk was at one point, there was an attempt to prohibit silk from being imported into countries in Europe. There was an attempt to keep silk from being exported out of China. You could face the death penalty for exporting silk out of China at one point in time. The same thing with a variety of other textiles in England and in France. There were periods of time when you couldn't export things like lace into France. You couldn't import lace into France. You couldn't import different types of wool into England or out of Scotland. Or there was just all kinds of goofy rules like this, and they have never worked. They have never worked at any point in time in history. They always create a black market, and they always create unexpected consequences that are worse than whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish with their prohibition. And, you know, the great example of this was the prohibition of alcohol, which is so well documented and so blatantly obvious that it should be beyond argument. There should be no reason whatsoever for a person today in North America to say that anything, any substance, any especially a recreational drug of some kind, should be prohibited when we have the prohibition of alcohol and the history of that so blatantly available to us to look at. So let's take that rant back just a little bit, and let's realize that the war on drugs is fought for two reasons. Think about this. The war on drugs is fought for two reasons, and a third side reason that almost doesn't matter. Reason number one, the war on drugs is fought. It puts a lot of money and power into the hands of a very small group of politicians and government officials. That's number one. That's the number one reason that we have a war on drugs, because it puts money and power into the hands of a small group of law enforcement and government individuals. Reason two, it puts a massive amount of cash in the hands of criminals, and those criminals, in turn, put money right back into the hands of the politicians. The criminal element wants the drugs illegal because they are making a fortune off of them. And they funnel part of that money back into the governmental hands, and they keep the thing going like that. And the third, but almost insignificant reason, is because there are very silly people in the public who are fooled by this whole process and think the government is their friend and the government can help them by getting drugs off the street. And those people are just pathetically fooled. And I really have a hard time having any mercy on those people, because all the evidence is so obvious that they are just being had, they are being taken advantage of, and their silliness and their naivety is just almost disgusting. So there we have it. So we have this war on drugs. Okay, now, so what's the result of the war on drugs? Well, I've gone through this before, but I'll do it again, and this time I'll try to go as quickly as possible so that I can get to my main point. The things that I'm about to say, I know about firsthand. In the 1970s, methamphetamine was readily available. Very few people wanted it because it's dangerous and it's scary, and it just sucks the life out of you. And there were other things available that were different but equally effective in accomplishing the goal of getting high. So in the 1970s, when methamphetamine was readily available, very few people used it. At the same time, among those same people that I'm vividly, that I was intimately acquainted with, cocaine was widely available. However, the cocaine usage was not at any kind of really, really high level. There was cocaine available, and it was used recreationally, and that was pretty much the end of it. On the West Coast, we had a variety of terminology was available. We most people referred to refined versions of cocaine as either freebasing, or they referred to the actual product as rock cocaine, or just rock. Now, on the East Coast, that was called crack. But on the West, and the media, when the media finally figured out that this stuff existed, it went crazy with the word crack rather than the word rock. But that's because of so much of the media is based on the East Coast. But on the West Coast, rock was readily available, and very few people regularly used rock cocaine. Most cocaine users used just regular cocaine. But even that was not that big of a problem in the 1970s. In addition to all the things I just said, there was a great abundance of marijuana in the 1970s. It was becoming very common. I've been pulled over by police on numerous occasions during the 1970s with small amounts of marijuana, and they would literally just dump it on the ground, give us a little lecture, and we'd be on our way, because it wasn't a big deal. Now, there were some things that were considered a lot more dangerous, and police were far more active in pursuing them, and those were things like LSD and heroin. Now, there was still quite a bit of LSD floating around, and there wasn't a real concentrated effort to do anything about it in the 70s, but everybody knew that if you were caught with it, you were in some serious problems. So there were some restrictions on the distribution and the sale of LSD. But heroin was a little bit different. There was, during the 70s, heroin had a pretty bad reputation, and cops would go after it pretty aggressively. Now, as the 70s became the 80s, there were a couple TV shows, and there was a couple of very popular movies that glamorized specifically the cocaine market. This caused... let me interrupt the story. Let's go back to a similar but even more ridiculous situation that is exactly the same thing. In the 1950s, most of America had no restrictions on knives, on carrying of knives. And a quite silly movie came out about gang members who sang and danced, West Side Story. They clicked their fingers and they sang and they danced and they fought with switchblades. It was entirely cartoonish in every way. It did not in the slightest way reflect any of the aspects of gangs or violence or anything else. And the switchblade was used strictly because of its appeal on the camera, in the way that it could be flicked out and very impressive or whatever. Now, let's see. How many of us have been in knife fights? I'm raising my hand. A switchblade is no particular advantage over any other kind of knife. As a matter of fact, it's a disadvantage in many ways. So the switchblade does not carry any particular magical qualities. However, because of this stupid musical about gang members where they click their fingers and dance, busybodies across America suddenly became terrified that gangs were everywhere with their switchblade knives. So guess what got outlawed? Now, you know who a switchblade knife is really handy for? A person who is out in really cold weather and needs a knife that they can open with really cold fingers that can't really function all that well. That's when a switchblade knife is most handy. Not for a fight. There are a variety of knives that I would prefer to use in a fight over a switchblade. But a switchblade is extremely handy when your hands are really cold and you're trying to do something with a knife, like cut a rope or something like that. So the switchblade knife is a wonderful utilitarian tool and a horrible fighting knife. And yet, because of the silly busybodies convinced by a stupid musical, switchblades were outlawed all over the United States. That's how stupid human beings can be when they get the authority of the state in their pockets. This is what happened in the early 1980s. There was not a cocaine problem. There was a couple of TV shows and movies that glamorized the cocaine trade. This caused people to think there was a cocaine problem. This caused them to demand something must be done. And of course, whenever someone demands something must be done, there's some two-bit politician willing to take advantage of that situation, line his pockets, and get some votes while he cracks down on crime. Sure enough, federal money starts flowing, and they start targeting the cocaine trade. As they target the cocaine trade, what do? Well, they force the cocaine trade to change slightly. Because instead of trying to smuggle a pound of cocaine, which is bulky, it's much easier to concentrate that cocaine into the rock form, or crack, and transport it as crack. So then, bulk cocaine becomes a problem to transport, and crack cocaine becomes the solution. So literally, the crackdown on crime caused the explosion of crack cocaine onto the market. Now, crack cocaine is far more dangerous and far more addictive than regular bulk cocaine. But now it's readily available on the market because it's so much easier to smuggle and move around and buy and sell. So the police interference in the market actually made the cocaine addicts, caused them to use a deadlier version and a more addictive version of cocaine. Now, with these problems comes another problem. As the economic end of the cocaine trade is interfered with by this enforcement of the drug wars in the early 80s. This causes an increase in the flow of money in different directions than it had been prior to the interference of the state. And so, among the crime people who are controlling the drug trades, there's more violence between them, not against cops, not against the public. More violence between them, fighting for a smaller share of this growing crack cocaine market. And so the violence between the actual criminal elements creates a situation where the criminal elements are more armed than they were just a couple of years prior. In the late 1970s, I could feel perfectly comfortable going into most drug trades. Well, my weaponry of choice, I'll just tell you how I outfitted myself in most situations. I had a piece of metal called a wrist pin. It was out of a Cummings diesel engine. It's a piece that's actually the piston itself connects to the, this is some technical here for the mechanics among us, but the piston itself connects to the piston rod, and then the piston rod connects to the crankshaft. So right where the piston connects to the rod, there is a pin that connects these two where it can pivot on that pin. Now that pin is a hardened steel, and it's about the width of a man's, the width of a man's hand, and it's round. It very much resembles like a, something between a roll of quarters and a roll of 50-cent pieces, but it's a little bit longer than that. And it's hollow, but it's hardened steel. It's a very durable steel with an extremely smooth surface because it's essentially a bearing. So essentially it's a roller bearing, really. But it fits perfect into your hand. Now, I always carried one of those. And that was to use basically the way a brass knuckle is carried. But I carried that, and I also carried a standard buck knife, and I also carried a very light chain around my underneath my belt, and this very light chain had a hoop like a sort of like a key ring on each end of it. And I carry, just on one end. On one end, it just had a little ball. And on the other end, it had a loop like a keychain, like just a single loop of a keychain. And I kept that underneath my belt all the way around my waist. And I could just give it a yank and pull the whole thing out. And there I've got like a 32-inch, essentially a 32-inch steel whip. So these were the things that I carried normally. I carried my wrist pin, my buck knife, and my little steel thing for a belt, my little chain belt. And that was my standard everyday carry when I was doing this type of activity. In addition, I had a couple pistols that, one very small and one a little bit larger, that I would carry if I needed to, if I felt the need, or if things were rough at that particular time or whatever, then I would carry one of those two pistols. And that's the way I went into, I've gone into some pretty rough places with nothing more than the wrist pin, the buck knife, and my little wire whip, or my little wire chain belt. Now, that's because violence in the late 70s among the drug trade was extremely rare. There were a few times, and even I was involved in one situation where we went in and robbed one drug house. One group of us took somewhere in the range of about $20,000-$25,000 worth of drugs from another group of drug dealers, but that kind of situation was extremely rare, and there was a lot of extenuating circumstances when that took place. When we went in there, we went in fully armed with both rifles and pistols, and we went in hard, and it could have turned out much worse than it did. Overall, in spite of the tale that I just now told, overall, the drug trade in the 70s was not a violent drug trade. But in the 80s, once the crackdown took place, there was a lot more criminal-on-criminal violence taking place because everything was moving toward crack cocaine. So then there was this panic. The public figured out that there was crack, such a thing as crack cocaine. And on the West Coast and in places like LA, the LA police got a armed personnel carrier, and they put a battering ram in the front of it, and it was very famous, and they started busting the rock houses. And so this created it elevated the level of violence that was taking place. So this drove the price of rock cocaine or crack cocaine to a level of where it was just unacceptable. And then the magic solution came into play, methamphetamine. Meth could be made pretty much in any decent kitchen. You could make it cheap, you could make it quick, you could make it easy, and you could sell it fast. Because the reason you could sell it fast in the 1990s and you couldn't sell it at all in the 1970s is because it's nasty. It is dangerous and it is nasty. And in the 70s, nobody wanted it because you could have powder cocaine and all the pot you wanted. Why would you want that nasty stuff? But by the time that the drug war had kicked into full gear in the 1990s, all of these things were getting harder and harder to come by. So the hardcore user was forced, due to these circumstances, to use methamphetamine, which is a far worse drug than crack cocaine or powder cocaine or any of the other things down the line. So here we are in the 90s. And as this level of violence has increased, the criminal on criminal violence increased along with it. There's greater levels of competition. There's people trying to get rid of their competition by turning them into the police. And there's more and more violence. So the criminals themselves become heavier armed. And so the police have to respond to that, because when the police make a bust and they go in to imagine had I been busted in 1978, I would have maybe had a briefcase in my trunk of my car with, let's say, 8 or 9 ounces of marijuana and maybe 4 or 5 ounces of cocaine and maybe a kilo of hash, all in a briefcase in the trunk of my car. And how would I be armed? I would be armed with a wire rope around my waist and a wrist pin and a buck knife, maybe a pistol. But a similar bust in the 1990s would not have included those things. It would have included something like a bunch of meth in a series of bags and a guy maybe with an Uzi, because you have to protect it from the other criminal elements. You see? So when the cop busts you with a wire rope around your waist, the cop is going to be in a completely different mindset when he busts you and you've got an Uzi under your coat. So, of course, the cops responded to this increase in violence that the state created by increasing in their own armament. And this is a never-ending escalation. As the cops increase their levels of violence and of the way that they were uniformed and so forth, the drug dealers did the same thing. And so, eventually, we have police that are essentially military. What really is the difference today? You go to any American city and you see how the elite groups of police are uniformed, and how they're armed. And in every way, there is nothing distinguishing them from federal troops. And now, let's get to what sparked this entire rant. I'll put a link in today's, on badquaker.com, today's podcast notes, to an article in the Washington Post where the headline reads, "Senior police officers meet at the White House as part of efforts to combat homegrown terrorism." And then you start reading through this article about the homegrown terrorism. And this Washington Post article is absolutely packed full of myths and lies about homegrown terrorism. It's lies. It's an excuse. It's using the so-called war on terrorism. It's using this already created mythology about the drugs and all the violence and all the things that we've grown to accept as absolutely necessary. The police have to be armed like this because of how heavily the drug dealers are armed. And it's taking that foundation and it's building upon it. And now using this so-called war on terror, and we're supposed to believe that there are just constant homegrown terror threats that are out after us. And so the police are now militarized and we move into the police state. Now, I didn't get to go at all into what I wanted to talk about, and maybe I can keep these notes and go for the next time. What I wanted to talk about was something called self-selection bias and the regulatory capture theory. And I was going to show that the process itself, that's the two things that I referred to. There's two things, and then there's one lesser thing. The two things, self-selection bias and the regulatory capture theory, guarantee that what I just described would happen. They guaranteed from 1800, when cities decided to have police and to use the force of the state in this manner. These two economic processes, self-selection bias and the regulatory capture theory, guaranteed that at some point we would reach a saturation and a police state would take place. And we're not quite there, despite what I just said a second ago. We still have more room to go. It's gonna get worse. And so we need to see it for what it is. We need to know the cause. We need to know its origin. And we need to know what that we can do about it. So this is going to have to be one in a series of two. And I'm going to have to do another one on the police. The one thing that I want to leave you with as I wrap this up is that I am not attacking individual police. I still believe that there are Andes out there, there are Sheriff Andes out there, and that the Sheriff Andes need to hear what I'm talking about and need to realize what it is that's happening around them so that they're not caught up in this thing and so that they can remain Sheriff Andes and not become a bunch of SWAT-armed Barney Fifes. Folks, thank you very much for listening. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much.